Once she had managed to comprehend the sheer fact that Ayumi had died, Aomame went through a brief period involving a certain process of mental adjustment. Eventually, when the first phase of the process ended, she began to cry. She cried quietly, even silently, burying her face in her hands, her shoulders quivering, as if she wanted to be sure that no one else in the world could tell that she was crying. The window curtains were shut tight, but still, someone might be watching. That night, Aomame spread the newspaper on the kitchen table, and, in its presence, she cried without interruption. Now and then a sob escaped her, but the rest of the time she cried soundlessly. Her tears ran down her hands and onto the paper. Aomame did not cry easily in this world. Whenever she felt like crying, she would instead become angry at someone else or at herself, which meant that it was rare for her to shed tears. Once they started pouring out of her, though, she couldn't stop them. She hadn't had such a long cry since Tamaki Otsuka killed herself. How many years ago had that been? She could not remember. In any case, it had been a long time before, and she had cried forever. It went on for days. She ate nothing the whole time and stayed shut up indoors. Now and then, she would replenish the water that she had cried out in tears, and then she would collapse and doze. That was all. The rest of the time, she went on weeping. That was the last time she did anything like this. Ayumi was no longer in this world. She was now a cold corpse that was probably being sent for forensic dissection. When that ended, they would sew her back together, probably give her a simple funeral, send her to the crematorium and burn her. She would turn into smoke, rise up into the sky and mix with the clouds. Then she would come down to the earth again as rain, and nurture some nameless patch of grass with no story to tell. But Aomame would never see Ayumi alive again. This seemed warped and misguided, in opposition to the flow of nature and horribly unfair. Ayumi was the only person for whom Aomame had been able to feel anything like friendship since Tamaki Otsuka left the world. Unfortunately, however, there had been limits to her friendship. Ayumi was an active-duty police officer and Aomame a serial murderer. True, she was a murderer motivated by conviction and conscience, but a murderer is, in the end, a murderer, a criminal in the eyes of the law. For this reason, Aomame had to make an effort to harden her heart and not respond when Ayumi sought to deepen their ties. Ayumi must have realized this to some extent, that Aomame had some kind of personal secret or secrets that caused her deliberately to put a certain distance between them. Ayumi had excellent intuition. At least half of her easy openness was an act, behind which lurked a soft and sensitive vulnerability. Aomame knew this to be true. Her own defensiveness had probably saddened Ayumi, making her feel rejected and distanced. The thought was like a needle stabbing Aomame in the chest. And so Ayumi had been murdered. She had probably met a man in the city, had drinks with him, and gone to the hotel. Then, in the dark, sealed room, their elaborate sex game had begun. Handcuffs, a gag, a blindfold. Aomame could picture the scene. The man tightened the sash of his bathrobe around the woman's neck, and as he watched her writhe in agony, his excitement mounted until he ejaculated. But the man tightened the sash with too much force. What was supposed to have ended at the point of crisis did not end. Ayumi must have feared that such a thing might happen. She needed intense sexual activity at regular intervals. Her flesh needed it. And so, perhaps, did her mind. Like Aomame, she did not want a regular lover. But Ayumi tended to wade in deeper than Aomame. She preferred wilder, riskier sex, Perhaps unconsciously, she wanted to be hurt. Amame was different. She was more cautious, and she refused to be hurt by anyone. She would fiercely resist if a man tried such a thing. But Ayumi tended to respond to a man's desire, whatever it might be, and she looked forward to finding out what he would give her in return. It was a dangerous tendency. These sexual partners of hers were ultimately passing strangers. It was impossible to find out what desires they possessed, what tendencies they were hiding, until the critical moment. Ayumi herself recognized the danger, of course, which was why she needed a stable partner like Amame, someone to put on the brakes and watch over her with care. In her own way, Amame too needed Ayumi, who possessed abilities that she herself happened to lack. An open, cheerful personality that put people at ease, a friendly manner, a natural curiosity, a positive attitude, a talent for interesting conversation, large breasts that attracted attention. All Amame had to do was stay next to Ayumi with a mysterious smile on her face. The men would want to find out what lay behind that smile. In that sense, Amame and Ayumi were an ideal team, an invincible sex machine. "I should have been more open and accepting with that girl," Amame thought. "I should have reciprocated her feelings and held her tight. That was the one thing she was hoping for, to be accepted and embraced unconditionally, to be comforted by someone, if only for a moment. But I could not respond to her need. My instinct for self-preservation is too strong, and so is my determination to keep Tamaki Otsuka's memory unsullied." So Ayumi went out to the city at night alone, without Amame, to be strangled to death, shackled by the cold steel of genuine handcuffs, blindfolded, her stockings or underwear stuffed in her mouth. The thing that Ayumi had always feared had become a reality. If Amame had accepted her more willingly, Ayumi would probably not have gone out that night. She would have called and asked Amame to go with her. They would have gone to a safer place and checked on each other as they lay in their men's arms. But Ayumi had probably been hesitant to impose on Amame. And Amame had never once called Ayumi to suggest an outing. It was nearly 4 o'clock in the morning when Amame found that she could no longer bear to stay alone in her apartment. She stepped into a pair of sandals and went out, walking aimlessly through the pre-dawn streets, wearing only shorts and a tank top. Someone called out to her, but she kept walking straight ahead. She walked until she was thirsty. Then she stopped by an all-night convenience store, bought a large carton of orange juice, and drank it on the spot. Then she went back to her apartment to cry. "I loved Ayumi," she thought, "even more than I realized. If she wanted to touch me, I should have let her touch me anywhere she liked, as much as she liked." The next day's paper carried another report, under the heading, "Police Woman Strangled in Shibuya Hotel." The police were doing everything in their power to catch the man, it said, and the women's fellow officers were utterly perplexed. Ayumi was a cheerful person who was well-liked by everyone, a responsible and energetic individual who had always earned high marks for her police work. Several of her relatives, including her father and brother, were also police officers, and their family ties were strong. All were puzzled as to how such a thing could have happened to her. "None of them know," Amame thought. "But I know." Ayumi had a great emptiness inside her, like a desert at the edge of the earth. You could try watering it all you wanted, but everything would be sucked down to the bottom of the world, leaving no trace of moisture. No life could take root there. Not even birds would fly over it. What had created such a wasteland inside Ayumi, only she herself knew. No, Maybe not even Ayumi knew the true cause. But one of the biggest factors had to be the twisted sexual desires that the men around Ayumi had forced upon her. As if to build a fence around the fatal emptiness inside her, she had to create the sunny person that she became. But if you peeled away the ornamental egos that she had built, there was only an abyss of nothingness, and the intense thirst that came with it. If she tried to forget it, the nothingness would visit her periodically, on a lonely rainy afternoon, or at dawn when she woke from a nightmare. What she needed at such times was to be held by someone. Anyone. Al-Mamet took the Heckler & Koch HK4 from the shoebox, loaded the magazine with practiced movements, released the safety, pulled back the slide, sent a bullet into the chamber, raised the hammer, and aimed the gun at a point on the wall with both hands solidly on the grip. The barrel was rock steady. Her hands no longer trembled. Al-Mamet held her breath, went into a moment of total concentration, and then let out one long breath. Lowering the pistol, she reset the safety and tested the weight of the gun in her hand. Staring at its dull gleam, the gun had almost become a part of her body. "I have to keep my emotions in check," Al-Mamet told herself. "Even if I were to punish Ayumi's uncle or brother, they wouldn't know what they were being punished for. And nothing I could do to them now would bring Ayumi back. Poor kid. Something like this had to happen sooner or later. Ayumi was on a slow but unavoidable approach toward the center of a deadly whirlpool. And even if I had been warmer to her, there were probably limits to how much that could have accomplished. It's time for me to stop crying. I'll have to change my attitude again. I'll have to put the rules ahead of myself. That's the important thing, as Tamaru said. On the morning of the fifth day after Ayumi died, the pager finally rang. At the time, she was in the kitchen boiling water to make coffee and listening to the news on the radio. The pager was sitting on the kitchen table. She read the telephone number displayed on the small screen. It was not one she knew. But it had to be a message from Tamaru. She went to a nearby payphone and dialed the number. Tamaru answered after the third ring. "All set to go?" Tamaru asked. "Of course," Al-Mamet answered. "Here is Madame's message. 7 o'clock tonight, in the lobby of the Hotel Okura's main building. Dress for work as usual. Sorry for the short notice, but this could only be arranged at the last minute." 7 o'clock tonight, in the lobby of the Hotel Okura's main building, Al-Mamet repeated mechanically. "I'd like to wish you luck, but I'm afraid a good luck wish from me won't do any good," Tamaru said. "Because you don't believe in luck." "Even if I wanted to, I don't know what it's like," Tamaru said. "I've never seen it." "That's okay. I don't need good wishes. There's something I'd like you to do for me instead. I have a potted rubber plant in my apartment. I'd like you to take care of it. I couldn't bring myself to throw it out."
"I'll take care of it."
"Thanks."
"A rubber plant's a lot easier to take care of than a cat or a tropical fish. Anything else?"
"Not a thing. Just throw out everything I leave behind."
"When you've finished the job, go to Shinjuku Station and call this number again. I'll give you your next instructions then."
"When I finish the job, I go to Shinjuku Station and call this number again," Al-Mamet repeated.
"I think you know not to write down the telephone number. When you leave home, break the pager and get rid of it somewhere."
"I see. Okay.
We've lined up everything to the last detail. You don't have to worry about a thing. Just leave the rest to us."
"I won't worry," Al-Mamet said.
Tamaru kept silent for a moment. "Do you want my honest opinion?"
"Sure."
"I don't mean to say that what you two are doing is useless. I really don't. It's your problem, not mine. But I do think that, at the very least,
It's reckless, and there's no end to it.
You may be right, Almama said, but it's beyond changing now.
Like avalanches in the spring.
Probably.
But sensible people don't go into avalanche country in avalanche season.
A sensible person wouldn't be having this conversation with you.
You may be right, Tamaru had to admit. Anyhow, are there any relatives we should be contacting in case an avalanche does occur?
None at all.
You mean there aren't any? Or they're there, but they're not?
They're there, but they're not.
That's fine, Tamaru said. It's best to travel light. A rubber plant is just about the ideal family.
Seeing those goldfish in Madame's house suddenly made me want to have some of my own. They'd be nice to have around. They're little and quiet and probably don't make too many demands. So I went to a shop by my station the next day, thinking I was going to buy some. But when I actually saw them in the tank, I didn't want them anymore. Instead, I bought this sad little rubber plant, one of the last ones they had.
I'd say you made the right choice.
I might never be able to buy goldfish. Ever.
Maybe not, Tamaru said. You could buy another rubber plant.
A short silence ensued. 7 o'clock tonight, in the lobby of the Hotel Okura's main building, Almame said again to reconfirm.
You just have to sit there. They'll find you.
They'll find me.
Tamaru cleared his throat. By the way, do you know the story about the vegetarian cat who met up with a rat?
Never heard that one.
Would you like to?
Very much.
A cat met up with a big male rat in the attic and chased him into a corner. The rat, trembling, said, "Please don't eat me, Mr. Cat. I have to go back to my family. I have hungry children waiting for me. Please let me go." The cat said, "Don't worry, I won't eat you. To tell you the truth, I can't say this too loudly, but I'm a vegetarian. I don't eat any meat. You were lucky to run into me." The rat said, "Oh, what a wonderful day. What a lucky rat I am to meet up with a vegetarian cat." But the very next second, the cat pounced on the rat, held him down with his claws, and sank his sharp teeth into the rat's throat. With his last painful breath, the rat asked him, "But Mr. Cat, didn't you say you're a vegetarian and don't eat any meat? Were you lying to me?" The cat licked his chops and said, "True, I don't eat meat. That was no lie. I'm going to take you home in my mouth and trade you for lettuce."
Almame thought about this for a moment.
What's the point? No point, really. I suddenly remembered the story when we were talking about luck before. That's all. You can take whatever you like from it, of course.
What a heartwarming story.
Oh, and another thing. I'm pretty sure they're going to pat you down and search your bag before they let you in. They're a careful bunch. Better keep that in mind.
I'll keep it in mind.
All right, then, Tamaru said. Let's meet again somewhere.
Again somewhere, Almama repeated by reflex.
Tamaru cut the connection. Almama looked at the receiver for a moment, grimaced slightly, and put it down. Then, after committing the number displayed on the pager to memory, she deleted it.
Again somewhere,
Almama repeated to herself. But she knew she would probably never see Tamaru again. Almama scoured the morning paper, but found nothing on Ayumi's murder. This probably meant that the investigation had turned up nothing new. No doubt all the weekly magazines would be mining the case for every weird angle they could find. A young, active-duty policewoman engages in sex games with handcuffs in a Shibuya love hotel and is strangled stark naked. Almame didn't want to read any sensationalistic reports. She had avoided turning on the television ever since it happened, not wanting to hear some female news announcer
reporting on Ayumi's death in the usual artificial high-pitched tones. Of course, she wanted the perpetrator to be caught. He had to be punished no matter what. But would it make any difference if he were arrested, tried, and all the details of the murder came out? It wouldn't bring Ayumi back, that much was certain. In any case, the sentence would be a light one. It would probably be judged to have been not a homicide, but involuntary manslaughter. An accident. Of course, not even a death penalty could make up for what had happened. Aomame closed the paper, rested her elbows on the table, and covered her face with her hands for a while. She thought about Ayumi, but the tears no longer came. Now she was just angry. She still had a lot of time until 7 o'clock in the evening, but nothing to do in the meantime. No work at the sports club. Following Tamaru's instructions, she had already deposited her small travel bag and shoulder bag in a coin locker at Shinjuku Station. The travel bag contained a sheaf of bills and enough clothing, including underwear and stockings, for several days. She had been going to Shinjuku once every 3 days to deposit more coins in the slot and double-check on the contents. She had no need to clean her apartment, and even if she wanted to cook, the refrigerator was nearly empty. Aside from the rubber plant, there was almost nothing left in the room that still had the smell of life. She had gotten rid of everything connected to her personal information. All the drawers were empty. And as of tomorrow, I won't be here either. Not a trace of me will be left. The clothes she would wear that evening were nicely folded and stacked on the bed. Next to them, she had placed a blue gym bag. Inside was a complete set of stretching equipment. She checked the contents of the bag once more for safety's sake. Jersey top and bottom, yoga mat, large and small towels, and small hard case containing the fine pointed ice pick. Everything was there. She took the ice pick out of the case, pulled off the cork, and touched the point to make sure it was still plenty sharp. To make doubly sure, she gave it a light sharpening with her finest whetstone. She pictured the needle sinking soundlessly into that special point on the back of the man's neck, as if being sucked inside. As usual, everything should end in an instant. No screaming, no bleeding, just a momentary spasm. Aomame thrust the needle back into the cork and carefully returned the ice pick to its case. Next, she pulled the t-shirt wrapped Heckler & Koch from its shoebox and with practiced movements loaded 7 9-millimeter bullets into the magazine. With a dry sound, she sent a cartridge into the chamber. She released the safety catch and set it again. She wrapped the pistol in a white handkerchief and put it in a vinyl pouch. This she hid in a change of underwear. Now, was there anything else I had to do? She couldn't think of anything. Standing in the kitchen, Aomame made coffee with the boiled water. Then she sat at the table, drinking it with a croissant. This may be my last job, Aomame thought. It's also going to be my most important and most difficult job. Once I've finished this assignment, I won't have to kill anyone anymore. Aomame was not opposed to losing her identity. If anything, she welcomed it. She was not particularly attached to her name or her face, and could think of nothing about her past that she would regret losing. A reset of my life. This may be the one thing I've longed for most. Strangely enough, the one thing that Aomame felt she did not want to lose was her rather sad little breasts. From the age of 12, she had lived with an unwavering dissatisfaction with regard to the shape and size of her breasts. It often occurred to her that she might have been able to live a far more serene life if only her breasts had been a little larger. And yet now, when she was being given a chance to enlarge them, a choice that carried with it a certain necessity, she found that she had absolutely no desire to make the change. They were fine as they were. Indeed, they were just right. She touched her breasts through her tank top. They were the same breasts as always, shaped like two lumps of dough that had failed to rise because of a failure to properly combine the ingredients, and subtly different in size. She shook her head. But never mind. These are me. What will be left of me besides these breasts? Tango's memory will stay with me, of course. The touch of his hand will stay. My shuddering emotion will stay. The desire to be in his arms will stay. Even if I became a completely different person, my love for Tango can never be taken from me. That's the biggest difference between Ayumi and me. At my core, there is not nothing. Neither is it a parched wasteland. At my core, there is love. I'll go on loving that 10-year-old boy named Tengo forever. His strength, his intelligence, his kindness. He does not exist here with me, but flesh that does not exist will never die, and promises unmade are never broken. The 30-year-old Tengo inside of Aomame was not the real Tengo. That Tengo was nothing but a hypothesis, as it were, created entirely in Aomame's mind. Tengo still had his strength and intelligence and kindness. And now he was a grown man, with thick arms, a broad chest, and big, strong genitals. He could be by her side whenever she wanted him there, holding her tightly, stroking her hair, kissing her. Their room was always dark, and Aomame couldn't see him. All that her eyes could take in was his eyes. Even in the dark, she could see his warm eyes. She could look into them and see the world as he saw it. Aomame's occasional overwhelming need to sleep with other men came, perhaps from her wish to keep the Tengo she nurtured inside her as unsullied as possible. By engaging in wild sex with unknown men, what she hoped to accomplish, surely, was a liberation of her flesh from the desire that bound it. She wanted to spend time alone with Tengo, in the calm, quiet world that came to her after the liberation. Just the two of them together, undisturbed. Surely, that was what Aomame wanted. Aomame spent several hours that afternoon thinking about Tengo. She sat on the aluminum chair on her narrow balcony, looking up at the sky, listening to the roar of the traffic, occasionally holding a leaf of her sad little rubber plant between her fingers as she thought of him. There was still no moon to be seen in the afternoon sky. That wouldn't happen for some hours yet. Where will I be at this time tomorrow? Aomame wondered. I have no idea. But that's a minor matter, compared with the fact that Tengo exists in this world. Aomame gave her rubber plant its last watering, and then she put Janacek's Sinfonietta on the record player. It was the only record she had kept after getting rid of all the others. She closed her eyes and listened to the music, imagining the windswept fields of Bohemia. How wonderful it would be to walk with Tengo in such a place. They would be holding hands, of course. The breeze would sweep past, soundlessly swaying the soft green grass. Aomame could feel the warmth of Tengo's hand in hers. The scene would gradually fade like a movie's happy ending. Aomame then lay down on her bed and slept for 30 minutes, curled up in a ball. She did not dream. It was a sleep that required no dreaming. When she woke, the hands of the clock were pointing to 4:30. Using the food still left in the refrigerator, she made herself some ham and eggs. She drank orange juice straight from the carton. The silence after her nap was strangely heavy. She turned on the FM radio to find Vivaldi's Concerto for Woodwinds playing. The piccolo was trilling away like the chirping of a little bird. To Aomame, This sounded like music intended to emphasize the unreality of her present reality. After clearing the dishes from the table, Almami took a shower and changed into the outfit she had prepared weeks ago for this day. Simple clothes that made for easy movement. Pale blue cotton pants and a white short-sleeved blouse, free of ornamentation. She gathered her hair in a bun and put it up, holding it in place with a comb. No accessories. Instead of putting the clothes she had been wearing into the hamper, she stuffed them into a black plastic garbage bag for Tamaru to get rid of. She trimmed her fingernails and took time brushing her teeth. She also cleaned her ears. Then she trimmed her eyebrows, spread a thin layer of cream over her face, and put a tiny dab of cologne on the back of her neck. She inspected the details of her face from every angle in the mirror to be sure there were no problems, and then, picking up a vinyl gym bag with the Nike logo, she left the room. Standing by the front door, she turned for one last look, aware that she would never be coming back. The thought made the apartment appear unbelievably shabby, like a prison that only locked from the inside, bereft of any picture or vase. The only thing left was the bargain sale rubber plant on the balcony, which she had bought instead of goldfish. She could hardly believe she had spent years of her life in this place, without question or discontent. "Goodbye," she murmured, bidding farewell not so much to the apartment as to the self that had lived here.
Chapter 6. Tengo. We have very long arms. The situation showed little development for a while. No one contacted Tengo. No messages arrived from Komatsu or Professor Ebisuno or Fukaeri. They all might have forgotten him and gone off to the moon. Tengo would have no problem with that if it were true, but things would never work out so conveniently for him. No, they had not gone to the moon. They just had a lot to do that kept them busy day after day, and they had neither the time nor the consideration to let Tengo know what they were up to. Tengo tried to read the newspaper every day, in keeping with Komatsu's instructions, but, at least in the paper he read, nothing further about Fukaeri appeared. The newspaper industry actively sought out events that had already happened, but took a relatively passive attitude toward ongoing events. Thus it probably carried the tacit message, "Nothing much is happening now." Having no television himself, Tengo did not know how television news shows were handling the case. As for the weekly magazines, virtually all of them picked up the story. Not that Tengo actually read them. He just saw the magazine ads in the newspaper with their sensational headlines. "Truth about the enigmatic disappearance of the beautiful, best-selling teenage author. Air Chrysalis author Fukaeri, 17. Where did she disappear to? Hidden background of beautiful runaway teenage author." Several of the ads even included Fukaeri's photo, the one taken at the press conference. Tengo was, of course, not uninterested in what the articles might say, but he was not about to spend the money it would take to compile a complete set of weeklies. Komatsu would probably let him know if there was anything in them that he should be concerned about. The absence of contact meant that, for the moment, there had been no new developments. In other words, people had still not realized that Air Chrysalis had, perhaps, been the product of a ghostwriter. Judging from the headlines, the media were focused on the identity of Fukaeri's father as a once-famous radical activist. The fact that she had spent an isolated childhood in a commune in the hills of Yamanashi, and her present guardian, Professor Ebisuno, a formerly well-known intellectual. And even as the whereabouts of the beautiful, enigmatic teenage author remained a mystery, Air Chrysalis continued to occupy the bestseller list. Such questions were enough to arouse people's interest. If it appeared that Fukaeri's disappearance was going to drag on, however, it was probably just a matter of time until investigations would begin to probe into broader areas. Then things might get sticky. If anyone decided to look into Fukaeri's schooling, for example, they might discover that she was dyslexic and, possibly for that reason, hardly went to school at all. her grades in Japanese or her compositions, assuming she wrote any, might come out, and that might naturally lead to the question of how a dyslexic girl had managed to produce such sterling prose. It didn't take a genius to imagine how, at that point, people might start wondering if she had had help. Such doubts would be brought to Komatsu first. He was the editor in charge of the story and had overseen everything regarding its publication. Komatsu would surely insist that he knew nothing about the matter. With a cool look on his face, he would maintain that his only role had been to pass the author's manuscript on to the selection committee, that he had had nothing to do with the process of its creation. Komatsu was good at keeping a straight face when saying things he didn't believe, though this was a skill mastered by all experienced editors to some degree. No sooner had he denied any knowledge of the deception than he would call Tengo and dramatically say something like, "Hey, Tengo, it's starting. The heat is on," as if he himself were enjoying the mess. And maybe he was. Tengo sometimes felt that Komatsu had a certain desire for self-destruction. Maybe deep down he was hoping to see the whole plan exposed, a big juicy scandal blow up, and all connected parties blasted into the sky. And yet, at the same time, Komatsu could be a hard-headed realist. He would be more likely to cast his desire aside than to sail over the edge toward destruction. Komatsu probably had it all figured out so that no matter what happened, he at least would survive. Just how he would manage it in this case, Tengo did not know, but Komatsu probably had his own clever ways of exploiting anything, be it a scandal or even total destruction. He was a shrewd player who was in no position to be criticizing Professor Ebisuno in that regard. But Tengo told himself with some confidence that Komatsu would be sure to contact him if clouds of suspicion began to appear on the horizon concerning the authorship of Air Chrysalis. So far, Tengo had merely functioned as a convenient and effective tool for Komatsu. But now he was also Komatsu's Achilles heel. If Tengo were to disclose all the facts, that would put Komatsu in a terrible position, so Komatsu could not afford to ignore him. All Tengo had to do was wait for Komatsu to call. As long as there was no call, the heat was not on. Tengo was more interested in what Professor Ebisuno might be doing at the moment. No doubt he was making things happen with the police, hounding them with the possibility that Sakigake was involved in Fukaeri's disappearance, exploiting the event to pry open the religious organization's hard shell. But were the police moving in that direction? Yes, they probably were. The media were already foaming at the mouth over the relationship of Fukaeri and Sakigake. If the police did nothing and important facts later emerged along that line, they would be attacked for having failed to investigate. In any case, however, their investigation would be carried out behind the scenes, which meant that no substantial new information was to be gleaned from either the weekly magazines or TV news. Coming home from the cram school one day, Tengo found a thick envelope shoved into his mailbox in the apartment building's front entrance. It bore Komatsu's name as sender, the logo of his publisher, and 6 special delivery postmarks. Back in his apartment, Tengo opened it to find copies of all the latest reviews of Air Chrysalis and a letter from Komatsu. Deciphering Komatsu's scrawl took a good bit of time. Tengo, there have been no major developments so far. They still haven't found Fukaeri. The weekly magazines and TV reports are mainly concentrating on the question of her birth and childhood, and fortunately the damage has not spread to us. The book keeps selling more and more, which may or may not be a cause for celebration. It's hard to say. The company's very happy, though, and the boss gave me a certificate of commendation and a cash bonus. I've been working for this publisher for over 20 years, but this is the first time he's ever had anything nice to say about me. It kind of makes me want to see the look on their faces if they found out the truth. I'm enclosing copies of reviews and other articles regarding Air Chrysalis. Have a look at them for your own enlightenment when you get a chance. I think some of them will be of special interest to you, and a few will make you laugh, if you're in the mood for laughing, that is. I had an acquaintance of mine look into that New Japan Foundation for the Advancement of Scholarship and the Arts we talked about. It was set up a few years ago, received government approval, and is now actively operating. It has an office and submits its annual financial reports. It awards grants to a number of scholars and writers each year, or so they claim. My source can't tell where they get their money, and he finds the whole thing just plain fishy. It could be a front established as a tax write-off. A detailed investigation might turn up some more information, but we don't have that kind of time and effort to spare. As I said to you when we last talked, I'm not quite convinced that a place like that wants to give 3 million yen to an unknown writer like you. There's something going on behind the scenes, and we can't discount the possibility that Sakigake has something to do with it. If so, it means they've sniffed out your connection to Air Chrysalis. In any case, it makes sense for you to have nothing to do with that organization. Tengo returned Komatsu's letter to the envelope. Why would Komatsu have bothered to write him a letter? It could simply be that as long as he was sending the reviews, he'd put a letter in with them, but that was not like Komatsu. If he had something to tell Tengo, he would have done it on the phone, as usual. A letter like this could remain as evidence in the future. Cautious Komatsu could not have failed to think about that. Or perhaps Komatsu was less worried about evidence remaining than the possibility of a wiretap. Tengo looked over at his phone. A wiretap. It had never occurred to him that anyone might be tapping his phone. Though, come to think of it, no one had called him in the past week. Maybe it was common knowledge that this phone was being tapped. He had not even heard from his older girlfriend, who liked talking on the phone. That was very unusual. Even more unusual was the fact that she had not come to his apartment last Friday. She always called if something came up to prevent her from visiting him, say her child was home from school with a cold or her period had started all of a sudden. That Friday, however, she had not contacted him. She simply never showed up. Tengo had prepared a simple lunch for them in anticipation of her arrival, but ended up spending the day alone. Perhaps she was stuck dealing with some emergency, but it was not normal not to have had the slightest word from her. Meanwhile, he was not able to contact her from his end. Tengo stopped thinking about both his girlfriend and the telephone. He sat at the kitchen table to read the book reviews in order. They had been assembled chronologically, the title of the newspaper or magazine and date of publication written in ballpoint pen in the upper left-hand corner. Komatsu must have had his part-time female assistant do it. He would never have undertaken such drudgery himself. Most of the reviews were positive. Many of the reviewers praised the story's depth and boldness and acknowledged the precision of the style, several of them finding it incredible that the work had been written by a 17-year-old girl. Not a bad guess, Tengo thought. One article called the author a Françoise Sagan who has absorbed the air of magical realism. This piece, though vague and filled with reservations, generally seemed to be in praise of the work. More than a few of the reviewers seemed perplexed by, or simply undecided, about the meaning of the Air Chrysalis and the Little People. One reviewer concluded his piece, "As a story, the work is put together in an exceptionally interesting way, and it carries the reader along to the very end. But when it comes to the question of what is an Air Chrysalis, or who are the Little People, we are left in a pool of mysterious question marks. This may well be the author's intention, but many readers are likely to take this lack of clarification as a sign of authorial laziness. While this may be fine for a debut work, if the author intends to have a long career as a writer, in the near future she may well need to explain her deliberately cryptic posture." Tengo cocked his head in puzzlement. If an author succeeded in writing a story put together in an exceptionally interesting way that carries the reader along to the very end, who could possibly call such a writer lazy? But Tengo, in all honesty, had nothing clear to say to this. Maybe his thoughts on the matter were mistaken, and the critic was right. He had immersed himself so deeply in the rewriting of Air Chrysalis that he was practically incapable of any kind of objectivity. He now saw the Air Chrysalis and the Little People as things that existed inside himself. Not even he could honestly say he knew what they meant. Nor was this so very important to him. The most meaningful thing was whether or not one could accept their existence as a fact, and Tengo was able to do this quite readily, which was precisely why he had been able to immerse his heart and soul in rewriting Air Chrysalis. Had he not been able to accept the story on its own terms, he would never have participated in the fraud, even if tempted with a fortune or faced with threats. Still, Tengo's reading of the story was his and his alone. He could not help feeling a certain sympathy for the trusting men and women who were left in a pool of mysterious question marks after reading Air Chrysalis. He pictured a bunch of dismayed-looking people clutching at colorful flotation rings as they drifted aimlessly in a large pool full of question marks. In the sky above them shone an utterly unrealistic sun. Tengo felt a certain sense of responsibility for having foisted such a state of affairs upon the public. But who can possibly save all the people of the world, Tengo thought. You could bring all the gods of the world into one place, and still they couldn't abolish nuclear weapons or eradicate terrorism. They couldn't end the drought in Africa or bring John Lennon back to life. Far from it. The gods would just break into factions and start fighting among themselves, and the world would probably become even more chaotic than it is now, considering the sense of powerlessness that such a state of affairs would bring about. To have people floating in a pool of mysterious question marks seems like a minor sin. Tengo read about half of the Air Chrysalis reviews that Komatsu had sent before stuffing them back into the envelope. He could pretty well imagine what the rest were like. As a story, Air Chrysalis was fascinating to many people. It had fascinated Tengo and Komatsu and Professor Ebisuno and an amazing number of readers. What more did it have to do? The phone rang just after 9 o'clock Tuesday night. Tengo was listening to music and reading a book. This was his favorite time of day, reading to his heart's content before going to sleep. When he tired of reading, he would fall asleep. This was the first time he had heard the phone ring in quite a while, and there was something ominous about it. This was not Komatsu calling. The phone had a different ring when it was from Komatsu. Tengo hesitated, wondering whether he should pick it up at all. He let it ring 5 times. Then he lifted the needle from the record groove and picked up the receiver. It might be his girlfriend. "Mr. Kawana," a man said. It was the voice of a middle-aged man, soft and deep. Tengo did not recognize it. "Yes," Tengo said cautiously. "I'm sorry to call so late at night. My name is Yasuda," the man said in a neutral voice, neither friendly nor hostile, neither impersonal nor intimate. Yasuda. The name was ordinary enough, but he couldn't think of any Yasudas he knew. "I'm calling to give you a message," the man said. He then inserted a slight pause, rather like putting a bookmark in between the pages of a book. "My wife will not be able to visit your home anymore, I believe. That is all I wanted to tell you." Yasuda. That was his girlfriend's name, Kyoko Yasuda. She never had occasion to speak her name in Tengo's presence, which accounted for the lag in recognition. This man on the phone was Kyoko's husband. Tengo felt as if something were stuck in his throat. "Have I managed to make myself clear?" the man asked, his voice entirely free of emotion, or none that Tengo could hear. He spoke with a slight accent, possibly from Hiroshima or Kyushu. Tengo could not be sure. "Not be able to visit," Tengo echoed the words. "Yes, she will no longer be able to visit." Tengo mustered up the courage to ask, "Has something happened to her?" Silence. Tengo's question hung in space, unanswered. Then the man said, "So what I'm telling you, Mr. Kawana, is that you will probably never see my wife again. I just wanted to let you know that." The man knew that Tengo had been sleeping with his wife, once a week, for a year. Tengo could tell that he knew. But the man's voice was strangely lacking in either anger or resentment. It contained something else, not so much a personal emotion as an objective scene, an abandoned, overgrown garden, or a dry riverbed after a major flood. A scene like that. "I'm not sure what you are trying to—" "Then let's just leave it at that," the man said, before Tengo could finish. A trace of fatigue was discernible in his voice. "One thing should be perfectly clear. My wife is irretrievably lost. She can no longer visit your home in any form. That is what I am saying." "Irretrievably lost," Tengo repeated. "I did not want to make this call, Mr. Kawana, but I couldn't sleep at night if I just let it go and said nothing. Do Do you think I like having this conversation? No sounds of any kind came from the other end when the man stopped talking. He seemed to be phoning from an incredibly quiet place. Either that or the emotion inside him was acting like a vacuum, absorbing all sound waves in the vicinity. Tengo felt he ought to ask the man a question or two. Otherwise, it seemed this whole thing would end as a collection of inscrutable hints. He mustn't let the conversation die. But this man had no intention of informing Tengo of any situational details. What kind of question could he ask when the other person had no intention of revealing the actual state of affairs? What kind of words should he give voice to when facing a vacuum? Tengo was still struggling to discover any words that might work when, without warning, the connection was cut. The man had set down the receiver without saying anything and left Tengo's presence, probably forever. Tengo kept the dead receiver pressed to his ear for a time. If anyone else was listening into the call, he might be able to grasp that person's presence. He held his breath and listened, but there were no telltale sounds. All he could hear was the beating of his own heart. The more he listened, the more he felt like a thief who has crept into a stranger's house at night, hidden in the shadows, holding his breath and waiting for the family to fall asleep. He boiled some water in a kettle and made green tea to calm his nerves. Cradling the handleless cup in his hands, he sat at the kitchen table and mentally reviewed the telephone call. "My wife is irretrievably lost. She can no longer visit your home in any form. That is what I am saying." In any form. That phrase disturbed Tengo the most. It suggested something dark, damp, and slimy. What this man named Yasuda wanted to convey to Tengo, it seemed, was the message that even if his wife wanted to visit Tengo's apartment again, it was literally impossible for her to carry out that wish. Impossible in what way? In what context? And what did it mean to say that she was irretrievably lost? An image formed in his mind of Kyoko Yasuda with serious injuries from an accident, or having come down with an incurable disease, or her face horribly disfigured by violence. She was confined to a wheelchair, or had lost a limb, or was wrapped head to toe in bandages, unable to move. Or then again, she was being held in an underground room, fastened like a dog on a thick chain. All of these possibilities, however, seemed far-fetched. Kyoko Yasuda, as Tengo was now calling her in his mind, had hardly ever spoken of her husband. Tengo had learned nothing about him from her, his profession, his age, his looks, his personality, where they had met, when they had married, whether he was skinny or fat, tall or short, or whether or not they got along well. All Tengo knew was that she was not particularly hard-pressed economically. She appeared to be quite comfortable, in fact, and that she seemed dissatisfied with either the frequency or the quality of the sex she had with her husband, though even these were entirely matters of conjecture on his part. She and Tengo spent their afternoons in bed talking of many things, but never once had the subject of her husband come up, nor had Tengo wanted to know about him. He preferred to remain ignorant of the man whose wife he was stealing. It seemed only proper. Now that this new situation had developed, however, he was sorry that he had never asked her about her husband. She would almost certainly have responded frankly if he had asked. Was her husband jealous, possessive? Did he have violent tendencies? He tried to put himself in the man's place. How would he feel if the situation were reversed? Say he has a wife, two small children, and a tranquil home life, but he discovers that his wife is sleeping with another man once a week, a man 10 years her junior, and the affair has been going on for over a year. What would he think if he found himself in such a situation? What emotions would rule his heart? Violent anger? Deep disappointment? Vague sadness? Scornful indifference? A sense of having lost touch with reality? Or an indistinguishable blend of several emotions? No amount of thinking enabled Tengo to hit upon exactly how he would feel. What came to mind through all this hypothesizing was the image of his mother in a white slip giving her breasts to a young man he did not know. Destiny seems to have come full circle, Tengo thought. The enigmatic young man was perhaps Tengo himself, the woman in his arms, Kyoko Yasuda. The composition was exactly the same. Only the individuals had changed. Does this mean that my life has been nothing but a process through which I am giving concrete form to the dormant image inside me? And how much responsibility do I bear for her having become irretrievably lost? Tengo could not get back to sleep again. He kept hearing the voice of the man who called himself Yasuda. The hints that he had left behind weighed heavily on Tengo, and the words he had spoken bore a strange reality. Tengo thought about Kyoko Yasuda. He pictured her face and body in minute detail. He had last seen her on Friday, 2 weeks prior. As always, they had spent a lot of time having sex. After the phone call from her husband, though, it seemed like something that had happened in the distant past, like an episode out of history. On his shelf remained several LP records that she had brought from home to listen to in bed with him, all jazz records from long, long ago, Louis Armstrong, Billie Holiday, this one, too, had Barney Bigard as a sideman, some 1940s Duke Ellington. She had listened to them and handled them with great care. The jackets had faded somewhat with the years, but the records themselves looked brand new. Tengo picked up one jacket after another. Gazing at them, he felt with growing certainty that he might never see her again. Tengo was not strictly speaking in love with Kyoko Yasuda. He had never felt that he wanted to spend his life with her, or that saying goodbye to her could be painful. She had never made him feel that deep trembling of the heart. But he had grown accustomed to having this older girlfriend as part of his life, and naturally he had grown fond of her. He looked forward to welcoming her to his apartment once a week and joining his naked flesh with hers. Their relationship was an unusual one for Tengo. He had never been able to feel very close to many women. In fact, most women, whether he was in a sexual relationship with them or not, made Tengo feel uncomfortable. And in order to curb that discomfort, Tengo had to fence off a certain territory inside himself. In other words, he had to keep certain rooms in his heart locked tight. With Kyoko Yasuda, however, such complex operations were unnecessary. First of all, she seemed to grasp exactly what Tengo wanted and what he did not want, and so Tengo counted himself lucky that they had happened to find each other. Now, however, something had happened, and she was irretrievably lost. For some unknowable reason, she could never visit here in any form. And according to her husband, it was better for Tengo to know nothing about either the reason or its consequence. Still unable to sleep, Tengo was sitting on the floor, listening to the Duke Ellington record at low volume, when the phone rang again. The hands of the wall clock were pointed to 10:12. Tengo could think of no one other than Komatsu who might call at a time like this, but the ring didn't sound like Komatsu's, which was always more high-strung and impatient. It might be Yasuda again. Perhaps he had forgotten to tell Tengo something else. Tengo did not want to answer. Experience had taught him that phone calls at this time of night were never very pleasant. Thinking of his current situation, however, he had no choice but to answer it.
"Yet is Mr. calling it,"
said a man. It was not Komatsu, nor was it Yasuda. The voice belonged unmistakably to Ushikawa, speaking as if he had a mouthful of water or some other elusive liquid. His strange face and flat, misshapen head came to Tengo's mind automatically.
"Oh, I'm sorry for calling so late. It's Ushikawa. I know I burst in on you the other day and took much of your valuable time. Today, too, I wish I could have called earlier, but some urgent business came up, and the next thing I knew, it was already this late. Believe me, I know you're a real early-to-bed, early-to-rise type, Mr. Kawana, and that's a very admirable thing. Staying up until all hours, frittering away your time, doesn't do anyone any good. The best thing is to go to bed as soon as possible, after it gets dark, and wake with the sun in the morning. But, I don't know, call it intuition. It just popped into my mind that you might still be up tonight, Mr. Kawana. So even though I knew it was not the most polite thing to do, I decided to give you a call. Have I caught you at a bad time?"
Tengo did not like what Ushikawa was saying, and he did not like it that Ushikawa knew his home phone number. Intuition had nothing to do with it. He had called because he knew perfectly well that Tengo was up, unable to sleep. Maybe he knew that Tengo's lights were on. Could someone be watching this apartment? He could almost picture one of Ushikawa's eager and capable researchers observing.